Hello and welcome to the program. You join us today at Maynooth University, where we will be debating issues around climate change with our panel and an invited audience of students who have a particular interest in this field. Maynooth University has been pioneering climate change research for decades, long before it became a subject of global importance. When the department opened way back in the 1970s, climate change was a niche field of study, and the university has been at the forefront of cutting-edge research ever since. I'm standing right now under the university's famous yew tree, which at about 800 years old is estimated to be one of Ireland's oldest native trees. Legend has it that the bold Silken Thomas himself, the 10th Earl of Kildare, played a lute under the boughs of this tree the night before he surrendered to King Henry VIII in 1535. So, it's fitting that we start our program here because as trees grow, they help offset our carbon footprint by removing carbon dioxide from the air, storing carbon within both them and the soil, and releasing oxygen into the atmosphere. Yet, deforestation continues apace. In 2018 alone, the world lost about 30 million acres of forest, an area nearly the size of Greece. Just one of the many alarming elements contributing to global warming. Leading climate scientists say that urgent steps need to be taken now in order to stop global warming from exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels and causing a climate catastrophe. A rise of even half a degree above that will significantly worsen the risks of drought, floods, extreme heat and poverty for hundreds of millions of people. We're here today to debate the issues that have caught the public's attention in 2019 as never before, and to explore what needs to be done to halt what seems to be the inexorable march towards irreversible climate change. And now we've made our way into the flexible learning room, it's called, which anyone familiar with the campus will know is on the first floor of Maynooth University's library building. And we're delighted to be here. Maynooth University has about 15,000 students, and we have some of them in our audience today, many who are from ICARUS, the Irish Climate Analysis Research Unit in the Geography Department here in Maynooth. So without further ado, let me introduce our panel, and we start with a man who's very familiar to our listeners, I think. That's Professor John Sweeney. He's one of Ireland's foremost climatologists and was a lecturer at Maynooth University Geography Department for 40 years until his recent retirement. Over the past 30 years, he has published approximately 100 scientific papers and edited and co-authored texts on various aspects of climatology and climate change in Ireland. He has served on a number of national academic societies as president, as well as being the Irish representative on a number of European academic bodies. He has led a range of nationally funded research projects examining various aspects of climate change in Ireland and contributed to the reports of Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The IPCC was subsequently awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Doesn't sound much like a retirement at all, John, I have to say. John Sweeney. Éanann Ealaíne is next, a regular Mooney Goes Wild panellist who holds degrees in botany and ecology from UCD. She has worked as a lecturer in DIT for the past 20 years, teaching the principles of sustainable development to both postgraduate and undergraduate students. She's former president of Antashka and is currently vice president of the Tree Council of Ireland. And apart from knowing absolutely everything about everything, her accent from County Louth makes her one of the most recognisable voices on radio. Éanann Ealaíne!
Stop slagging the old ass.
That was a compliment. And next we have Dr. Richard Collins, another Mooney Goes Wild regular, who holds degrees in electrical engineering, philosophy, and a PhD in zoology. A weekly columnist on environmental topics with the Irish Examiner since 2002, he also teaches at the Adult Education Department in University College Dublin, where he's known for his quirky and colourful lecturing style. That's Dr. Richard Collins at the end. Our student representative on the panel today is Natasha Seifert. Having completed a degree in geography at Loughborough University in the UK, she's currently doing an MSc in climate change at Maynooth University. Natasha is interested in climate change because she'd like to make a positive and sustainable contribution to the future of our planet and build bridges to connect climate research and policy makers. Welcome, Natasha. And last, but by no means least, Dr. Conor Murphy is Senior Lecturer in Geography in Maynooth University's Irish Climate Analysis and Research Department. He's a former student of John Sweeney, who he cites or blames as being the inspiration for his chosen career path, which just about brings us full circle on our panel. Conor Murphy. Now, the format of this program is fairly straightforward. We have a panel here, we have an audience here. You can ask the questions, they will do their best to give you the answers. But I think we should start by asking Professor John Sweeney, 1.5 degrees, this is a figure we're hearing a lot lately. Now, can we stop it from rising above 1.5 degrees? It's a question I'm asking you very early on. I mean, is there a point beyond which it's irreversible? There ain't anything we can do, we might as well just batten down the hatches.
It will be very difficult indeed to stop warming over 1.5 degrees simply because we're already globally at a level of 1 degree of warming above pre-industrial times. We need to reduce our emissions by 2030 by a factor of 45% globally to have a chance of avoiding 1.5 degrees. And we need to decarbonize effectively the global economy by the middle of the century to avoid hitting 1.5 degrees. Now, that entails a pace of change, social change, lifestyle change, changes in our energy systems, changes in the way we manage our resources, which is going to prove very challenging indeed. But it doesn't mean we should give up on it, because ultimately, if we give up on it, the conditions down the road will be even worse.
John, I was going to say, you were saying that we were already up at 1 degree above pre-industrial levels. So the 1.5 is not 1.5. It's actually only 0.5. We're one already. We've already gone up 1 degree. So we've only a half degree left to save the atolls. So, I mean, it's not as if we have this whole 1.5 and 2 waiting for us not to go at it. We already have done 1 degree already, and this accounts for the changes that we see. And with every increase in the temperature after that, the changes become more extreme.
Yes, and that's what we call tipping points, in the sense we know that there are certain tipping points in ecosystems where, once started, it may not be possible to recover the ground lost later on. The coral atolls are a good example. They will be gone at about 2 degrees centigrade, 2.5 degrees centigrade warming. The other areas of concern would be the West Antarctic ice sheet, would be the melting out of Greenland, which may take centuries to proceed, but once started, maybe very, very difficult to stop. And then down the road, if we fail to meet that 2 degree value, if we hit 3 or 4 degrees, we face problems like the loss of the Amazonian rainforest. We face much more dangerous tipping points from which it will be very difficult indeed to keep the Earth's population at a sustainable level such as we have at the moment.
Chris Phillips is in our audience. Chris, you want to ask a question?
Do you think we can achieve the 2 degree target?
I think I'd be optimistic about the 2 degree target because I think people's perceptions are changing very quickly now. And I think there's a willingness to tackle these difficult choices that we will have to make to stay within 2 degrees. It will be easier to stay within 2 than 1.5 degrees, certainly, but it will still entail quite a lot of changes in the way we run societies. You know, somebody once said, I think it was Bishop Tutu, that he was a prisoner of hope. And I think we have to be prisoners of hope in this area, because once we lose heart and give up, then we're on the slope to really bad conditions down the road.
Natasha.
Yeah, I think that's true. The thing is, we know the facts now, so we have to do everything to, you know, to reach that 2 degree target.
What are the facts? Yeah. You're the student here, so how do we reach that target? What do we have to do?
I think it takes a lot of policy adjustments. We have been a generation of economic growth and a lot of consumerism that has to change into renewable energy. A lot of renewable energy has to become, you know, the cool new things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, the policies have to change to finally make adjustments. They have to put pressure on firms to enact and make better adjustments.
There's a combination involved here. I think as individuals, we have to be responsible citizens and we have to do our bit. But we have to do our bit on a pathway which I think we have to be shown by leadership from decision makers and government in particular. I think we can get we can despair very easily after a while if it's all left to us as individuals and we don't see the correct signals coming from government. And that's been the most disappointing aspect, I suppose, of Ireland's performance in the past decade or so, that having undertaken commitments to our colleagues in the EU, we then basically ignored them and we set other priorities.
How bad are we?
We are, I think, the third worst per capita in the EU at the moment in terms of our greenhouse gas emissions. We have about 12 tons of greenhouse gas emissions per capita. Everyone in the room here is responsible for emitting about a ton of greenhouse gases every month, indirectly and directly.
This is what the individual can do. You said to the panel, what can the individual do? Well, what the individual can do is exercise their vote. So the individual, every individual, goes out and votes for somebody who is able to make a difference. And you quiz them when they come around to ask you for your vote. If you're concerned about it, ask them what their policy is on climate change. This matter will have been brought up on the doorsteps for anybody that goes along looking to be elected. And that's what the individual can do, exercise the franchise.
Richard.
I think it needs to be said that this is somewhat irreversible.
Oh dear.
If you want a bath, you have to heat up the water.
And you could have a cold bath, Richard.
And it takes a long time to do so. Now, most of the energy that's coming down due to climate change, coming down anyway, apart from climate change, is going to warm up the oceans. Now, the oceans like your bathwater, take a long time to come up. And if you reach some kind of stable emissions situation, they're not going to go down very quickly. It's going to take donkey's years for those oceans to go in the opposite direction. So we're not going to get back to some halcyon days of long ago where the oceans were all at a nice temperature and the fish were all the ones we're familiar with. We're looking at something rather different. Now, I disagree with Anna about blaming the politicians. The politician is essentially a man with a stethoscope.
Or a woman.
Forgive the ladies present. The politician has to sound out what the public mood is. And then he offers policies in the hope he'll get elected by pushing those particular policies. Now, unfortunately, and if somebody like Anna comes stridently wanting something and the politician doesn't like it, he won't put it up. It is we who are responsible, not the politicians. Scapegoating the politicians is a cop-out. We are, in fact... Now, I remember lots of crises. I'm old enough to remember the terror of a thermonuclear war. People were building shelters when I was young. There was a tremendous fear. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember the AIDS crisis. I remember things like the famous Millennium Bug, which never happened. And we overcame those things, most of them. The Millennium Bug turned out to be nothing. Now we're facing another thermonuclear conflict, a conflict over the environment, which will lead to a thermonuclear war if we don't solve it. I think that the experience of the past is that if we're at the pin of our collars, we can rise to this, I hope.
So can I ask you then, are you a Barack Obama man? Yes, we can. Or are you a Donald Trump man? There ain't nothing to see here.
Well, I'm certainly not a Donald Trump man, whatever else I am.
Derek, can I come back to your question in terms of individuals and who takes action? Carbon emissions come from all parts of economy and society, and nobody here has even mentioned the private sector. I think the government has a really important role in providing the regulatory context in which the private sector operates. But I also think the government has a really important role in vision for the future, the strategy, the long-term vision, the infrastructure, the sources of energy, opening the doors for people to take action. Everybody always talks about what the individual can do, and John mentioned the per capita emissions. It's always down to the individual, but it's a society, and we need to think of this problem at a societal basis. It's the private sector, it's the public sector, it's individuals, and how government can create, I guess, the environment within which people can act. We've seen in recent times that never before have we had this willingness to act on climate change, that it's now part of public discussion. It's part of everybody's narrative about the future. government politicians need to provide the opportunities for people to act, whether it's electrifying our cars and electric vehicles or retrofitting homes. We see that that's expensive for individuals. How do we encourage, how do we provide the scaffolding for people and the economy to change?
John.
Yeah, just returning to your point about sustainable transport, I think we've made several mistakes in Ireland. Our transport emissions have increased by 130% since 1990, and we are one of the most car-dependent countries in the world. The average Irish car travels almost twice as much as the average German car, for example. But there are options for us, and in this university, for example, we run a commuter bus service to many of the large country towns in the Midlands of Ireland, which has proven very successful and has enabled students to not be dependent on cars to come to college. So, you know, with a bit of insight, with a bit of imagination, we can do that. To give everybody in Ireland free public transport would cost about 500 million euros. That's probably less than we're subsidising fossil fuels in Ireland by a large amount currently.
Can we take some more questions? Daniel Conway has a question. Daniel.
Question for John Sweeney. The policy, farm and agricultural policy in place now is GLAS, but it's more focused on carbon emissions. At ends this year, what should be the next policy for farmers to encourage environmental practices? Should be more focused on nitrogen or ammonia reduction?
Well, I think, first of all, we are in excess of our national emissions ceiling limit value for ammonia, 98% of which comes from agriculture. And we're likely to face infringement proceedings from the EU over the next few years on that basis. The negotiation that's currently taking place on the reform of the Common Agricultural Policy has two very important dimensions to it. One is what will go into Pillar 1, which is mainly the single farm payment, and what will go into Pillar 2, which is principally looking after the environment, rewarding farmers for stewardship of their farms, looking after watercourses, those kinds of things. And there's tension between those two. The Commissioner very keen on and I believe it's right that they should reward farmers for allowing fields maybe to flood in winter time, for managing biodiversity better, rather than simply rewarding farmers for pouring more nitrogen onto perennial ryegrass and stacking up dairy farms, which are giving us all sorts of problems with our national total. So I think the farming model that we have now needs to evolve, and it needs to evolve in a way which makes it more sustainable in the long term, because the last thing I want to see is fines coming down the line which will cause divisions in Irish society between urban and rural, because our farmers, we have great farmers in Ireland, but in a sense they're being directed in the wrong way at the moment, and I think we have to start rewarding them much more for not producing, but rather for maintaining and stewarding the landscape. And I see that as the way ahead, and I know that the Commission are very happy to do that, but the vested interest groups get to work, and the people who have the most influence then tend to be the large farms, the large producers, the intensive producers. Sadly, 18% of our beef kill at the moment comes from cows that never see the light of day in enclosed feedlots. And that's a model I don't want to see increasing in the future, because it will destroy the great value we have in Ireland of a clean, green image. So I think we have to look much more seriously at protecting that image by going for a farming model in the future which is not based on intensification. I would start restricting nitrogen as a first step in that.
We also have to encourage farmers to plant trees. 50% of Ireland is covered in grass. 50%. 11% of Ireland is covered in trees. And much of the land of Ireland is owned by the farmers. So to encourage them to put trees on their land is something that we really need to do, that they mustn't be looking on planting trees as a way of imprisoning their land, of never being able to use it again, of seeing trees as somehow the enemy in a way. It has to be something that is part of the way you run your farm, rather than removing the hedgerows, making the fields bigger, corners, coppices. If you landed it with a helicopter, although why you'd be in a helicopter, I don't know. But if you landed in the middle of France or in Spain, you would know you weren't in Ireland. The landscape there is different. Here in Ireland, we have a bocage landscape. We have our fields surrounded by hedgerows, which are getting fewer and fewer and fewer. Fields are getting bigger. And the amount of trees that are planted on farms, not necessarily, I'm talking about plantations where you might grow timber as such as a crop, but to put in more trees on your land. Now, the glass scheme that you mentioned does encourage this, but we have to encourage a positive approach towards, if you have land, that you would plant some of it as something you would want to do rather than you're paid to do or you have to do or something of that order. Because actually, at the end of the day, the only way of getting carbon out of the atmosphere is by photosynthesis, is by your tree growing. And if we use 1 tonne of carbon every month that we put it up, emit it, as you say, a fully grown tree has 5 tonnes of carbon in it. So a fully grown tree will take, if it's an oak tree, 80 years to grow. And if it's a fast growing tree that has an evergreen tree like a Sitka spruce, it'll take 40 years to grow. And in 1 month, in 5 months, because if one person does a tonne a month, in 5 months, us Irish people are the equivalent of a fully grown tree. How many fully grown trees have we planted? We should have started 50 years ago.
But we can start now.
Well, we can only start now.
Yeah, we can only start now, that's what I'm saying. But how many do we need to plant? And where do we plant them?
Well, the government's plan that they brought out on climate action there in June promised that 2.3 million trees on 8,000 hectares will be planted every year from now to 2040. Will they? We underspent the forestry budget by 11 million in 2018, and we had a shortfall of 44% in trees planted. And that was 2018. This year's trees figures don't look any better. So they didn't even spend the money that they had allocated to plant trees in 2018.
But you're on the Tree Council of Ireland, ain't it?
Yeah, the Tree Council is a charity.
Look,
it's not part of the
banging down the door saying, give us the money, we'll spend it.
We have the door broken down, but we're a charity. We are a charity whose aim in the Tree Council is to improve and increase awareness, to make sure that the people to whom we speak are able to understand the importance of this. And we're doing a fair good job of it too, I have to say. But, I mean, that's what the government is doing. Why aren't they planting trees? 2.3 million trees on 8,000 hectares. They're going to do. Yeah, that's good on paper. The policies in this country are like St. Augustine. You know his policy. Make me pure, but not yet.
Natasha, I presume you agree with that. Have you ever planted a tree?
I have, actually.
How many have you planted in your lifetime? How old are you, by the way? Is it okay to ask?
Yeah, I'm 22.
22. How many trees have you planted?
About one.
Okay. Well, this is interesting now. So, Aina, how many trees have you planted?
I have planted hundreds of trees because, as President of the Tree Council of Ireland and Vice President at the moment, an important person on the Mooney Goes Wild show over the years, even you, Derek, have planted trees,
goodness knows,
because we've planted special old trees on occasions when you're invited down places. I mean, the last thing I was at recently was down in Kilcullen during National Tree Week, where we planted 700 trees. Now, I didn't personally dig all the holes, you know, but I cracked the whip and the rest of them planted it. That's good.
It seems like you've given us the answer. You know, plant trees. It seems to be fairly obvious and fairly easy. We can keep driving our cars so long as we plant lots of trees.
No, but we can't keep driving our cars. We plant lots of trees and we don't keep driving our cars.
Yes, I know.
We have to win the battle, not just balance.
But I'm just wondering how many people in the audience, and as I said, the audience is comprised of students here today, it's on radio, but put your hands up and I'll give some indication. Have all of you planted trees at any stage? So a good 70, 80, 90%, I think, of the audience, maybe even 95% of the audience have planted trees. Richard, you've planted trees, I take it?
I have, though not in... I'm not such a great landowner as others.
No, but you have a garden.
But I've done my modest little bit. I can't help thinking that the position with farmers is similar to that with politicians. We tend to blame the farmer. The farmer is not necessarily a cattle rancher. He is not necessarily a sheep man. He's raising those animals to supply our demands for food. And if we should change our demands for food, the farmer, who is a food producer primarily, will have to change and will change.
So you want to go vegan, do you?
No, I'm not.
Vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian.
You're going to stop eating red meat?
Yes, I have stopped eating red
completely.
Meat. Completely?
Completely.
Well,
for
if
what
I go to somebody's
reason?
House, I won't throw the plate back at you.
But for what reason?
For the reason that it's 35 kilos of CO2 per kilo of beef produced. It's something like 32 kilos of CO2 per kilo of lamb produced. If you go down to Turkey, it's around only 12 kilos of CO2 per kilo of turkey produced. Vegetables are way down, around 6 or 7, I think, or maybe even lower. Others will have the figures off the top of their heads. So change the diet. It's hard, of course.
It's a personal choice. Connor, do you like red meat?
I do, yes. But I would be like many people that I know in my social circles are trying to cut down on the amount of red meat. From a health perspective, from an environmental perspective, from many perspectives, I think it makes sense. But I want to come back to your point about agriculture. And one of the frustrations I've had with Irish policy in this area in particular, the debate, has been the rural versus urban. And I think we have to get past that. It's about all of the sectors. Mm-hmm. Our rural environment is crucial to the well-being of our rural communities and so on. And I'd also like to ask an interesting, I guess, a controversial question about afforestation. It's an important part of our climate strategy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But also by planting a lot of trees, it opens up, I guess, a vulnerability to the experience of drought in future. Drought is one of the impacts of climate change that we expect to become more frequent in future. With lots of trees on the landscape, it decreases the amount of water that reaches the land surface. So the point that I'm trying to make is that we have to be careful that the mitigation policies that we're implementing are not exacerbating the potential impacts of climate change in the future. And afforestation contains some of those risks if we're not careful about what we plant and where we plant. So ask me what the right species to plant is.
I was going to say plant them by the...
I would
have irrigation channels and have desalination plants and then water the trees that way.
We had,
I know you don't think so, but
we had news today saying that the Derrybrien wind farm that caused destabilisation and a big bog burst and a whole destruction of the side of the mountain washed away in the early 2000s has eventually come to the European Court of Justice, and Ireland has been fined because they didn't produce an environmental impact study on this before it happened. Now, if you have your overgrazed mountain sides eaten right down to the scut, even the heather been eaten with the 8 million sheep we had at one point, and the heavy rain comes, not a grand soft day anymore, but stair rods, and it comes down on a completely exposed mountainside in the west of Ireland, what is it going to do when you wash the thing down? I put it to you, if that was covered in trees, the trees would stop the impact of that runoff and would slow it down. I mean, tropical rainforest, when it rains, you're inside, you can hear the rain, but when the rain is all finished and done, it still trickles down through those trees, down into the ground. So if we had much more mountains covered in forests, when these rains come, they would not wash away the soil because of the slope and the fact that they're covered in blanket bog. Now, I'm not saying plant the trees on the blanket bogs because that would negate the thing, but just plenty of places you could plant them that they would break the impact of these stair rods of rain. And our rain events, the actual amount of physical rain that comes per shower is much greater now than it was before.
Inna, I would agree with you there in terms of where we talk about flood risk. Afforestation has clear win-win opportunities
reducing
greenhouse gases and also slowing down the rainfall response and stopping soil erosion as well, which is problematic for our water quality.
Yeah, but we should have started all of this years ago because the first few years after you make a plantation of trees, you actually lose carbon to the atmosphere because of respiration.
Yeah, because you're setting it up.
Disturbing the soil. Mm. And it takes a number of years before you actually recover that loss. So we have to ensure that when we do plant trees, that they are allowed to grow to maturity and that they're not coppiced and they're not sort of harvested really before maturity is reached. The other thing that Connor mentioned about drought vulnerability, of course, applies to pests as well of our trees, because with our warming climate, we're getting an influx of pests and diseases which we hadn't really experienced before, and they will no doubt grow in intensity and grow in problematical areas for us in the next decade, because we don't know whether those trees will be around in 50 years' time or 40 years' time, if they're going to be attacked by new generations of pests, if the weevils are going to become more prolific, for example, or the horse chestnut leaf miner makes inroads into our chestnuts.
Or the longhorn beetle.
And that's important, because if we are going to plant trees for our pensions, We want to be sure that they're going to be there in the kind of drought conditions that Connor's mm-hmm. talked about, for example, that will become more frequent in the years ahead. So it's very much a balancing act that we have to be careful of.
Yeah, but lots of councils are stopping using pesticides now as well. So insects are on the rise again. I notice it myself. I drive around the country. You know, you say it before, Aina, look at your license plate, see if there are any insects on it. A few years ago, there were none. Now they appear to be back again.
So that's great.
No, that's great, yeah. But you have to control these pest species without killing everything else.
You don't. You let nature do it. You let your bats eat them. You let your birds eat them. You let your swallows eat them. You let the natural part of the food chain happen. And if you don't have your food chains in place, if you've got rid of all the higher levels of it and you're poisoning the lower levels with insecticides, then you ended up with concentrated on the food chain and our top predators being poisoned by concentrated doses of poisons. It's not rocket science. 30, 40 years ago, our places were covered and insects or car number plates because we weren't covering the countryside with pesticides. And the reason why you don't get it now is because we've made the landscape less favourable for creatures to live in, and we have removed the predators that feed on them along the way. And that's what it is. So if we stop poisoning, the insects will be food for the next level in the food chain and our biodiversity would improve.
Katie Dooley, you have a question for Richard, I believe.
Yeah, Richard, I've heard that we are entering into the sixth great extinction. Is that true?
Yes and no. There are something at least 20 candidate great extinctions on the books going way back. It's convenient to say there have been five because it's like world wars. You know, there have been two in the last century. 55 million died in the second one and something like 30 million in the first. But would we include the Napoleonic Wars as world wars? Well, it's kind of arbitrary, or something like the 30 Years' War. An enormous number of people died in that, or the Roman War. But in a sense, it's going up and down all the time, and there have been five very spectacular ones. The Great Permian die-off, something like 250 million years ago, it killed off 90% of all the land mammals and 70% of all the sea, the fish and discernible species in the sea, in the fossil record. The most recent one, of course, was the 66 million years, the KT boundary, the meteorite that struck the Earth and wiped out the dinosaurs. It took care of something like 70% of the land animals, as far as I know. So in a sense, yes, there have been five, and we are certainly the sixth. There's no doubt about that, the rate at which we are eliminating things now.
So you think we could become extinct?
Us?
Yeah. Us. Well, starting with you. But yes, us, humans.
Well, sure. If we go on destroying our bed and the support system which sustains us, it will come home to roost. Look at the way we were recently, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons on hair triggers. Now we still have these blooming nuclear weapons, and a new anger has developed between the West and Russia, and they're armed with nuclear weapons, and we hear that other fellow Trump to go back on the treaties now, you know. So if you look at it in global terms, I mean, long term, it's an explosion. Our thing is an explosion. 1 million people in 1830, 1,000 million in 1830, 2,000 million in 1930, 7,500 million now. People on this earth is going rocketing up, and usually explosions end in chaos and debris. I think it's a very real possibility. The Sahara will be in Paris before long if we don't do something about it.
Since 1970, the number of vertebrate wildlife on Earth has dropped by 60%, and the decline in freshwater fauna has been 80%. Now, not 80% of species, but physical numbers. So 60% of our vertebrates, 80% of our freshwater fauna, gone since 1970. I think you could say, as somebody said once, read my lips, are we in the middle of an extinction? What do you think?
Aina, can I ask what the key drivers of those numbers are? Is it climate change?
The key drivers of those numbers are, as Richard Collins said, 7.7 billion people on Earth having to be fed, and they're not making any more land. So if we have to grow crops and have animals and feed these people, I mean, the most animals on Earth are farm animals and humans by a huge proportion. Like 80 or 90% of all the animals on the Earth are either farm animals or humans. So it's the feeding of those and the creating of all of these farm animals to feed the humans. Land use is what's causing this.
I keep hearing in debates that are happening about it's the population, human population. I think that can oversimplify it. It's how we consume rather than our numbers, because we have enough land to feed ourselves. We have enough resource if it's sustainably used. And I'd just like to be slow to back off a bit from the use of population numbers is the driver. It's how we consume as a population. If we change that, we have plenty of resource to go around.
Would you agree with that, Aina?
Yeah, it's how we consider the carrying capacity of the planet. I mean, the carrying capacity of the planet could well be exceeded because of the numbers of people we have demanding the standard of living that we are demanding. I mean, here in the West, we have a very high standard of living. Mm-hmm. And then we look at people in developing countries and say to them, well, if you get to the standard of living that we have, the world has gone to hell in a handcart, so you can't. I mean, that's what Mary Robinson refers to as climate justice. It was all right for us. We didn't know any better. We removed all the trees in Europe and made farmland out of it. But when the fellas in the Amazon want to cut down trees to have farmland there, they're very bold indeed, because we did it in our time. Actually, the human race has removed half the amount of trees there ever was on this planet. So climate justice has to have a huge impact on this if fair is fair.
82% of people in the world have never been in an aeroplane.
And many percent?
82% of people alive today in this world have never flown. And yet in Ireland, the statistic comes out at 6 flights per person per year in Ireland. Look at that for an imbalance.
You can blame Ryanair for that, I'm sure.
Suppose you wanted to multiply the number of airports, aircraft, installations, fuel and everything else up by 5, by 4 to get it, bring it right up. My God, it would be a dreadful world.
Yeah, but it's grand to say something like that, Richard, but you'll still get in a plane tomorrow and go to Africa or go to India. I'm not having a go at you.
Please,
but you will.
I love how you...
But isn't it true?
I deserve...
You've got to not get into the plane.
I deserve to be crucified, okay. Derek. I really do. I think we have to stop thinking about climate change. Climate change is part of a larger thing, habitat destruction. And creatures are... The physicists say that space and time are part of one entity. The main killer of creatures in the world is their habitat being destroyed and damaged, their environment being damaged. And climate change is one of the great factors changing the habitat. There is a continuity between habitat change, habitat destruction, and temperature, and that's extremely important.
We're here in many of us are from a geography department. We need more geography, which integrates the natural, the social, and the understanding of how we live in our world, which is exactly what we need. Geography.
And the geography that Aina talked about between the Amazon and the developed world is very important, because the principle under which the United Nations climate change policy is developed is based on historic but differentiated responsibility. That we in the developed world have a responsibility to try and ensure that the people in the developing world do not make the same mistakes as we did. And that responsibility has to be achieved by a transfer of resources from the developed world to enable them to make that sustainable transition. We've been very slow at doing that, not least in Ireland, where our contribution to the Green Climate Fund, for example, currently works out at 60 cents per person, whereas some of the other countries in Western Europe have up to 60 euros per person.
I want to take some questions from the audience before we finish. Yeah, we'll start with Steve.
Thanks, Derek. Yeah, Stephen McCarron in the Department of Geography here in Maynooth. I was just struck by something that Connor just mentioned there, and it's part of the conversation at university level about the integration of the social and the resource implications of change and society and the way we use and consume. And I'm just wondering, could I find the panel's opinion about the dropping of geography as a junior cycle subject in schools and the impact that that might have in 10 or 15, 20 years?
Natasha, what do you feel about this?
Yeah, I think... In all schools, really, there should be geography and it should not be dropped. And I also feel like there should be a course or maybe a subject in geography, you know, climate change, what we as citizens have to do.
John.
Yeah, if you apply for any research projects in Europe or indeed anywhere in the developed world these days, the first question that you're asked is, what's the degree of interdisciplinarity or multidisciplinarity in your application? And it's a reflection of the fact that many of the research questions that we asked in the past of very specialized disciplines have failed to deliver the answer. Science, for example, had often a very basic assumption that if you push A, it causes B to move. That sort of very simplistic approach. We now know that doesn't work, and it doesn't work in particular in climate change. We can't simply solve climate change through a very narrow disciplinary approach. We have to bring in a much broader approach. And geography, to me, is the ones I did geography because it had that ability to straddle both the science and the social sciences and integrate them in a way which no other subject was capable of doing, to my understanding anyway. And I think that's the great value of having a subject for younger students to grapple with those complexities and not to be funneled down highly specialised areas where they're oblivious to some of the other allied aspects of the topic they're studying.
Connor.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with John. And I think it's a really retrograde step to remove geography as compulsory because it's at a period in those young adults' lives that they are getting an understanding of how the world works. And geography offers a really important insight to that. We need, for all of the crises that we look at in the world today, we need that interdisciplinarity.
Richard.
I used to be a disciple of Ivan Illich, but I no longer am. He believed that all schools should be abolished and that people should take their children to work with them and the neighbour should do the same and the child would learn to do. I'm against compulsion of all sides. What we need is to foster a love of knowledge and education, the joy of knowledge and the points race, getting 550 points to come into John's course or whatever it is. I mean, that's a form of compulsion. We should remove compulsion and encourage love. And I would love to see a comprehensive arts on the one hand and science, a general sciences, a kind of general philosophical view of the world from which people should start and then progress down the lines that they that particularly interest them. I'm an idealist, I'm afraid. Living in a dream world.
Jack, you want to ask a question? Jack Dunn.
My question's for John. You mentioned the unthinkable. What do you think has to be considered there, or what do you mean by that?
Well, I think as we approach, if you like, the dangerous climate change threshold, I'm worried that we might start taking radical steps which might damage our long-term prospects of sustainability. I mean, there have been some very grandiose schemes suggested, such as damming the Bering Strait, for example, such as spraying coal dust on the ice caps. These came out many decades ago, and I worry that they will start resurfacing again as a kind of technological fix. Spraying iron into the ocean, for example, is one that's resurfaced quite recently. To me, these are unthinkable short-term solutions because rather than change us, they're seeking to manipulate the environment even more to accommodate the current society we live in. But there is a sort of radical department which has been set up, I believe, in Oxford, I'm not sure, but I think to devise the unthinkable options that we might have for the future. Currently, our perhaps most untried technology is carbon capture and storage. And that is something that we're assuming is going to be technologically feasible. But as yet, we haven't demonstrated this anywhere in the world.
Catherine Dooley has a question for Natasha. Catherine.
So I hear the word resilient being thrown out quite a lot nowadays. What does it mean to be resilient?
That's a good question, yeah. So in climate terms, it's basically meant to prepare for, recover from, and adapt to impacts of climate change. So basically, you know, climate change will have impacts, and it's the way how we will cope with such impacts.
Can I ask, are all of your friends and associates and family members and distant family members, are they concerned about the environment? Are they concerned about climate change? Are they fed up listening to people talking about it and telling us how miserable it's going to be and that we're all doomed?
Yeah, that's very true. A lot of my friends and family, they are concerned about it, but it's more like a frustration. Like, I feel a frustration.
Like that's Brexit, is it?
Yeah, but it's more frustration that we always talk about it and we are seeing slow changes. Like, the changes are emerging slowly. However, I don't think they're emerging fast enough. And that's why we keep on talking about, you know, the same facts and the same issues. But I think there has to be a new agenda for finally actually implementing such changes.
Why? For me, it seems like everything changed this year. And it seemed to be all based around Greta Thunberg. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. That when she appeared on the scene, that people really started to talk about climate change. Of course, people like John and Connor and our own programme has been talking about climate change since we came on air 30 years ago. But it seems like the public imagination was woken by this young girl.
I think she's great. She's, you know, she's finally brought a voice forward and given so many other students and so many other children a voice. And she started this big movement that, you know, children are not going to school on Fridays. And because of her, essentially, it's come into everyday conversation. Like, we're gathered around the dinner table and we're talking about it. Hmm. It's not just, you know, what are you studying? Oh, I'm studying climate change. It's actually, it's a proper conversation topic now. And that's, I think, is great.
Connor.
For me, I just wanted to say that Greta Thunberg, the most inspirational aspect about her is for those who are feeling anxiety at home and wondering what I can do, she has shown us the extent of the change that one person can make and how rapidly that change can cascade all across the world. Rapid change can happen because of individuals.
Greta Thunberg and to a lesser extent Attenborough both captivated the last conference of the parties in Katowice for different reasons, but they are effectively communicating that climate change is not an economic issue any longer. It's not an issue of macroeconomics, of marginal abatement cost curves. It's an ethical issue.
It's a personal issue. That's what Greta Thunberg did. She made it personal. You are stealing my future.
It's an intergenerational equity issue. And that, I think, has begun to dawn on people, largely through awareness that the limited carbon budget we've left, if we burn, we have no options for that next generation to get back to recover the ground. So I think that kind of intergenerational awareness is what's behind the young people. They are our leaders now. We follow them. And I think it's very important that we listen to them because they are the voters of the future. They are the people who will determine how radical the changes over the next decade will be for us to actually avoid some of those bad scenarios that we've talked about.
Katie, where are you, please?
This is a question for John, but also the panel. You mentioned earlier on that there are glacial and interglacial periods. How do you know this is not just a normal natural warming period?
Well, we can use our climate models now for, if you like, backwards modelling, and we can tweak them to enable us to project and predict when the last glacial, when the last interglacial was, and so on. We know those are primarily driven by astronomical factors rather than human factors, obviously. But we know now that we're into what we call a super interglacial. And such is the case that we've warmed up the atmosphere now to the extent that we know that the next glaciation, which normally might be expected to arrive in about 50,000 years, is probably not going to happen now. We're entering into a changed conditions called the Anthropocene. We are now driving climate, not the natural processes. Now, we may get downturns as those natural processes kick in a little, but they are thousands and thousands of years away. We will have burned all the carbon we have in the world by then. And let's hope we're around for those.
One last question from our audience. Ciara Crosby. Ciara.
Hi, John, you mentioned earlier that Ireland had declared a state of climate emergency. Are we really in a state of climate emergency? And if so, what does it really mean?
Well, I think we're in a state of climate emergency when the house is burning effectively, as Greta Thunberg said. When you have an emergency, you send in the fire brigade to that kind of house. What it means really is that we should be throwing out of the window all our preconceptions about climate actions and taking very much more radical steps than we have up till now. We need to tackle both the climate and the biodiversity emergencies together. But so far, we've effectively just paid lip service to it, and we haven't really taken the steps necessary to, I suppose, make a dent in the problem at a national level. And what it means is that we're still acting on the international stage as if what's good for us, what's good for Ireland, is good for the world. And that's the problem that we have to overcome, because countries tend to act in their own national self-interest rather than seeing the global emergency that we now face. So I think, you know, we've seen that young people are well aware of what that emergency entails. And I think what we should be doing is now following their lead in urging much more radical action than we've seen thus far.
Now, there's not universal consensus on climate change. There's a vociferous minority of sceptics both inside and outside the scientific world who deny climate change at all. And then there are others, including leading figures, who sometimes raise an eyebrow with their controversial comments. Would you like to hear what they had to say? Danny Healy-Ray, you all know Danny Healy-Ray, you know the name anyway. He said, God above is in charge of the weather and we can't do anything about it. He said that to the Dáil in 2016. David Bellamy, OBE, some of you will be familiar with that name. He's an environmental campaigner and botanist. He said, global warming is poppycock and that the global warmers are telling us lies. Carbon dioxide is not the driver. Donald Trump, we all know Donald Trump. I don't believe in climate change. The concept of global warming was created by and for the Chinese in order to make US manufacturing non-competitive. It's freezing outside. Where the hell is global warming? He said. And Sammy Wilson, former Northern Ireland Environment Minister. Environmentalism is a hysterical pseudo-religion. Climate change is natural and beyond our control. So resources should be used to adapt to the consequences of climate change rather than King Canute-style vanity trying to stop it. And what do you say to people who say that, well, climate change is always happening? Climate is always changing.
Climate change fluctuates, or climate fluctuates for natural reasons, from changes in solar activity to natural cycles. We're very clear that the temperature increases and other changes that we're seeing in the climate system today are because of human activities.
So it's due to man. Absolutely no question about that.
No question. No other types of change that happen naturally in our climate system can explain the type of change we've seen so far.
What about the sceptics in all this, John, just before we finish up?
Well, I think they're a dwindling breed at this stage, which is very fortunate. I think there are still some individuals out there who are quite dangerous. Many of the people you've just mentioned, of course, have a very limited climate science background, and they use words like, I believe, rather than, I looked at the thermometer and this is what it said, which is a bit more objective. And I think, we can hopefully see their demise in the future coming, although they are well-funded, they have very powerful vested groups behind them. So I think they'll be around for a while yet. But the science is now overwhelming. The science is no longer in dispute. For the first time in human history, it's us that's in charge of climate, not like our forefathers who were dependent on the vagaries of climate for saving the harvest or saving the hay. So I think we increasingly as a population recognise that the sceptics represent the past, and the kind of people you see here, the young people, they represent our best hope for the future.
John, thank you very much indeed. So before we finish, I'd just like to ask each of our panellists for a very quick comment on what is their greatest fear or hope for the future. Aina.
Well, my greatest fear actually is that we will run out of time to do anything about it. And then, of course, my greatest hope is that we won't. So I fear the worst and I hope for the best.
Natasha?
My greatest fear is that we don't use this momentum of wanting to make change. And my greatest hope is that we use this momentum and actually finally implement change.
John?
My greatest hope is that the young generation at the moment are our best prospects for the future. I see them rather like the cavalry coming over the hill to rescue people. My greatest fear is that we will effectively allow vested powerful interests to thwart the wishes of our decision makers in expressing what the general population want to see, which is radical steps to tackle this problem.
Connor?
I think Natasha read my mind. We are at a critical juncture, and my hope is that we take advantage of that, and as a global society, we make the changes necessary, and my fear is that we miss the boat.
Richard?
My view during the day is different from that at night. The thing in the middle of the night, I fear that what's ahead is terrible, destruction. But I wake in the morning and we solved the carbon fluorocarbon problem. That was a whole problem. We did solve that, and we can do it again on a grander scale.
Thank you very much indeed. That's just about all we have time for. Before I finish, I wish to thank each of our panellists. I want to thank Richard Collins. A round of applause for Richard. Connor Murphy, John Sweeney, Natasha Seyfert, and Aina Nilana. I want to thank the university here for facilitating us. A particular thanks to the students who came along today, armed with questions which sparked such energetic debate. And Maynooth MSc Climate Change course has been shortlisted for the MSc Course of the Year by Grad Ireland. So congratulations to everybody here. RTE technical and production staff who made today's programme possible. And last but by no means least, thank you to each and every one of you for listening at home. For more information, you can visit the website, which is rte.ie/media. Until next week, goodbye.
And there's a very interesting follow-up article online written by tonight's panellist, Professor John Sweeney, entitled Ireland and Climate Change, Are We Up For It? That's at rte.ie/Mooney. And you'll also find an extensive archive of related topics there too.